Well, today we're going to talk about Christians and war. So we had a lot of American Civil War history given to us recently. We went to Fort Sumter in South Carolina. Now, did you know how many, do you guys know how many casualties were at Fort Sumter? How many people died during that first battle? Zero. Right? I mean, that was kind of one of our favorite facts. We didn't know that. And you contrast that with a lot of the other casualties of the Civil War. And here's the introduction. During the American Civil War in 1862, Confederate troops held a low ridge called Maury's Heights near Fredericksburg, Virginia. Union troops sent to assault Maury's Heights had to cross exposed ground. Wave after wave of Union troops charged but were cut down before they could reach the Confederate lines. Over 12,000 were slain. Watching the battle, General Robert E. Lee turned to General James Longstreet, whose men were holding Maury's Ridge. It's well that war is so terrible, else we would grow too fond of it. So, we've been, I don't know, are we technically engaged in a war in Afghanistan, or is that pretty much war-free right now for the first time in a long time? But, I mean, how can our first-hand inexperience with war, continental Americans have not experienced an actual war since the Civil War, right? Now, how can our first-hand experience, our life first-hand experience, skew our attitudes towards war? Do we have any veterans in here? Veteran? Where did you serve?
Army.
Army in Vietnam?
Way back there, yeah. I was in the Vietnam era, didn't go.
Okay.
Stayed stateside the whole time.
Okay.
Right at the end time.
Okay.
About half the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so how can our inexperience with war kind of color our view of it?
I know that for me, there's a curiosity. So both Chris and I have grandfathers that were in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
There's always been a curiosity to ask about it, and to tell us what it was like to be there, to be in the war.
Mm-hmm.
Get their perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed very foreign.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that the general population will support war when they think the cause is just, and when it becomes popular the cause is unjust or not necessary, then I think when the population turns against the war,
mm-hmm.
that's when things go bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. It'd be interesting to brainstorm. What are some modern war movies?
American Sniper.
American Sniper.
Axel Ridge.
Axel Ridge.
Saving Private Ryan.
Saving Private Ryan. You didn't like that one, Sandy?
Don't even ask me about that.
It took Sandy to see that when she put her fingers in her ears and closed her eyes.
Yeah.
It was tough.
Yeah.
I didn't.
Same.
It's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Band of Brothers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Saving Private Ryan, the first 10 minutes. I mean, I heard people got PTSD. Yeah, people with PTSD and everything had to leave. I mean, it was just so amazingly realistic of what it was like.
See, that's an example where we lost a huge number of people, but the population,
yeah,
you know, was supportive of the whole
mm-hmm.
thing because the cause was just.
Yeah.
And so we'll accept a big loss as long as we're
mm-hmm.
headed in the right direction.
Yeah. There's some other, like Black Hawk Down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's another one where it's kind of a gritty movie that kind of shows modern warfare. American Sniper shows modern warfare. And the Hurt Locker was an interesting one too. That kind of shows the addiction to war and what it does to people. But I think like American Sniper is interesting because it talks about how war changes people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that people can't leave the war. I mean, they can't, you know, the difficulty of reintegrating into regular life. I mean, so whether it's death, casualty, and that's just the soldiers, right? You know, often we don't think of it in terms of what is life like after the war.
Mm-hmm.
Like, rebuilding a country. Yeah, so I mean, war is, for those who aren't acquainted with it, I mean, the only glimpse I think we really get into it are basically the cinema, movies, and production of those things.
Yeah, when you say over 12,000 are slain, that's saying that is one thing, but like if it's your father, your brother, you know, somebody you know,
yeah.
It's closer, then it's different. Than
yeah.
Or I think that you get a lot different perspective, like reading accounts, books that are, say, from the Civil War, from those times where you
mm-hmm.
you had a bit of an insight into what it was like. I think Chrissy read that
mm-hmm.
recently and had a lot of conversations just how, yeah, it would, you'd see people that you know, friends. And
mm-hmm.
I had a great uncle that was killed in World War One, and it was interesting. I found a couple of letters that was written back and forth to his folks, and those before, they were, people were gung-ho about going to war in World War One. They were just on fire. They were ready to go, and he was in the National Guard and was in on the Mexican border for quite a while, a couple, 3 years, and then they just decommissioned him, and then they sent him to France, and weren't there very long.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the sad part of it for his folks is that he was killed just a couple weeks before the
mm-hmm.
war was over.
Yeah.
So, you know, but the attitude, you know, the way his folks portrayed his attitude towards the war, he was pretty gung-ho about it.
Yeah.
Everybody was,
Well, that kind of, why are some people just overly fond of war?
If it's a just cause, you feel like you're fighting for, you know, the freedom of your people or against
mm-hmm.
people who are persecuting those
freedoms. Yeah. If it's a just cause, you feel like you're fighting
like
for something worth fighting for.
Right. Mm-hmm. Guys felt bad if they couldn't go. My dad couldn't go, and he just felt terrible about that. He could be there.
Yeah.
His brothers were
yeah.
there. He just, it was hard on him.
Mm-hmm. So why do you think that was the case? Why do you think it was hard on him?
Because he felt like that was his duty to defend
mm-hmm.
his country. I mean,
yeah.
That was huge.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a sense in which you are, like we've talked about, you're created to be, to lead, provide, and protect.
Yeah.
Especially for the men. And so there's a certain obligation, I think, that's just got created in there. You, that
mm-hmm.
if you believe that people or are at risk, or
mm-hmm.
you feel an obligation thing.
Yeah.
I think in some ways, war is like the most masculine thing you can possibly do. I mean, I look at my two boys. They have a fascination with war. They know facts. They know the battlefield strategy. They can set up their little toys the way that the
mm-hmm.
actual battles happen. There's just this, it's like the ultimate strategy game,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's, everything about it is macho and dangerous
mm-hmm.
and risky. And I mean, in a lot of ways, that's really good that, like, you know, 9/11 happened and my generation was aroused to sign up
mm-hmm.
and go.
Mm-hmm.
And it's primarily the men
mm-hmm.
who were, you know, kind of rose to the occasion, because it's just a very masculine thing, like you said, to protect and to, you know, I get women can be in the military and all those things, but it is a very masculine endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
I have zero interest or desire in war. None. Because I think of the hospitals in war areas. I think of the mothers. I think of the children. And, you know, our kids think, our boys think about doing one of the things God created them to do. And it's just like all of the, I mean, it's like football, but with lives.
Yeah.
Just strategy.
Chris and I talked about how, you know, when you're in a peaceful, prosperous, you still create games and sports
yeah.
in order to simulate.
Yeah.
Battle, yeah. To act out what normally, you know, I mm-hmm. told Luke, you know, you can do things on a football field that are illegal to do in the different context. You know,
yeah.
you just run up
yes.
and hit someone, right? And but it's like a training to still somewhat itch that desire for the masculine.
Yeah, it's part of the reason why people love football. It's the most combat type sport that we have.
It's funny, but
although I did watch Aussie Rules football,
I will tell you, you know, like the difference in a lot, the as a teacher seeing the high school kids, some of the things have changed over the last 10, 20 years, but the change from kids being more physically active to online, like all of the boys, that they only play war games, right? Mm-hmm. It's either sports or war games. Those are dominate 99% of what's played when they go to be. They don't go and play Candy Crush all day long. So it's even then, when they're not acting in the physical way, they're still mentally engaged in that.
And I think it's the opportunity to prove valor, right? You look at, when you see a statue, I mean, you think war hero, right?
Yep.
This person served, I mean, Timmerman. Why do we have the Timmerman Elementary School? Because he was a Medal of Honor winner. We have veterans memorials, you know? So there is a sense where dying for your country is a way of achieving lasting honor. Even if you're not alive to see it, you know that that's what is waiting for you should you do so in a heroic way, right? Now, why are some people overly critical of war? Yeah.
Well, there's a concept that we don't have anymore, which is the draft, which was in place when I went in. So I was drafted, didn't ask to go, got to go. But it was my own fault because I quit school and just took my chances with the lottery, which I won that one or lost it, I think. But I was in with a lot of guys that had college degrees that when they graduated, they lost their educational deferment and got drafted. So they got out of college and went and got drafted in the Army, get paid $90 a month. And there was a lot of bitterness about that kind of thing because at that time, the Vietnam War was very unpopular.
Yeah.
And, you know, those guys did not want to be there.
Yeah. Why else are people overly critical of war?
Not understanding the reason for the war is probably the biggest thing I can think of. Not being a clear-cut reason for the war as well.
Yeah.
That, and like with Vietnam, there's suspicion of some less than good intentions for oil reasons and for wealth reasons. And while that part of the war would have been bad if that had been true, there was also a lot of human suffering. So there was a balance, and that was that human suffering that made that war justified, is to help people, to protect people.
Yeah. Yeah, why else are people kind of suspicious? I'll say overly suspicious of the war.
Take, for instance, in World War One, the actual purpose of the war was not so clear-cut, you know? Nobody really knew what they were... Some people didn't understand what they were fighting for, and, like, you take one of the Christmases that they did, and they just... Each side had a ceasefire, and they all came together. And it was... It's one of those things where you're not... A lot of times soldiers are going after other soldiers who have the same...
Yeah.
They have families, they have... There's a heart there, there's a soul there, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not just back and forth. It's...
Yeah.
Or, like, you know, ideology versus ideology. It's souls versus souls.
Yeah. Yeah. Can I say something, Seth?
I think it also could be a partly of... people getting tired of war. We saw two really big wars in World War One and World War Two, and I think the country as a whole just got to a point where we're just getting sick of war.
Yeah.
I think the way that the men come back, the ones that do, and the fact that many don't, I think that's one reason why.
Or they come back different.
Right. The way that they come back can make people really critical. And
yeah.
Or the fact that they don't, those losses physically or the way it affects people.
Yeah.
something about not facing war on our soil for, what, 150 years, mm-hmm. is that we can be very optimistic. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have this naivete that says everything can be dealt with by negotiation, mm-hmm. by diplomacy. I majored in international relations and political science. Mm-hmm. Not everything can be dealt with mm-hmm. by diplomacy. I mean, so you mm-hmm. look at what happened in Ukraine. None of us wish that we had gone to war there over Ukraine, but what happened is a country took over part of another country. Mm-hmm. And we're naive if we think that we could have or should have negotiated our way out of that. Mm-hmm. And so all it takes is for Putin to become a Hitler, mm-hmm. which is it's a change in degree, not in kind. Mm-hmm. And we have World War II again, mm-hmm. where we have to respond.
Yeah.
You know, but right now, because we have never been the ones under assault, really since, I guess, Pearl Harbor, you could say we were attacked, definitely. That's now how many generations passed. But that wasn't by a country. That was by a rogue, you know, terrorist.
Yeah.
So that's a couple of generations that have passed since we have been faced with the fact that you can't negotiate your way out of everything.
Yeah.
There
right.
are lots of people who think that we should have negotiated our way around what happened at 9/11.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of the youth that are nearing, you know, this high school, they'll oppose war because they view it as fighting for the government.
Yeah.
You know, why do you want to go fight for these leaders?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because they don't perceive a risk or a threat to their life, anyone else's life. They view war as something that happens across the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And also there's a lack of consideration for those people who are dying that we might go to...
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Well, they're just Ukrainians. They kind of get mowed over by everything. Oh, well.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a horde of Vikings coming every spring to ransack and
mm-hmm.
our villages, you know, kill the men and rape the women. We might have a different attitude towards war, right? if we were truly victims in that way. And, you know, we have been protected by... providence of God and possibly nuclear weapons as well, right? Where the stakes of a nuclear holocaust has caused everyone to be a little bit more reluctant. So there is some deterrence there. But in general, what should be our disposition towards war?
Reluctantly willing.
Yeah, reluctantly willing. Okay. So that's what we're going to talk about today. I mean, this has become a pretty explosive issue. When I wrote this originally, we were enmeshed in the war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I don't know. I mean, looking back, it didn't turn into a Vietnam. You know, it was something that we did end up winning. But it brought up a lot of real interesting... threads. One was that, you know, there was a certain betrayal that many people felt that we didn't have the right pretext for going to war, that we were lied to about that. And I think that still is maybe a controversial question, you know, whether or not it was worth it in the end. But this is a quote I got from a theologian. It said, "Our culture's deep-seated skepticism about force as a moral enterprise is exacerbated by the second cultural development. I refer to the climate of postmodernity that encourages radical moral skepticism, stubbornly refuses to identify moral markers whatsoever, and is committed to a path of non-intrusive non-judgmentalism. Such is the social climate in which we presently live. Not only does our culture not assist us in making moral judgments, it discourages us from doing so." Now, I would possibly update that a little bit, where... yeah, I think there has been a little bit of a moral change where, you know, there is a moral skepticism, but we live in a day and age where, because of critical theory, people have developed these true claims of community. You know what I'm saying? Where there is a true claim from, let's say, somebody who's a critical race theorist, you know, that blacks have been oppressed for generations. And to make things right, we need to take these actions, right? And the truth claims are based off of the shared experiences of African Americans who have been oppressed. you can translate that to gay Americans or feminist ideology. Do you know what I'm saying? So I think postmodernity has morphed, where it's not just critical of all truth. I think they've realized that to be critical of a truth, you have to stand for another truth. And so postmodernity has offered communities of truth. Yeah, which is part of the reason why there could be a great civil conflict where you have two truth communities that ultimately go to war with each other. You know, so when people talk about a civil war or something like that, I mean, it's not outside the possibility. But there is a real moral skepticism and I think even cynicism, right, that people have towards the government. In a divided country, it's very difficult to anticipate something that would really rally the cause and cause all of us to come together at this point. Not that it can't happen in the future. So there has been just a real erosion, I think, because of that. And I think our country is just tired of war. It's interesting that when Donald Trump ran for the presidency 4 years ago, he did it on an anti-war platform within the Republican Party. Which was pretty novel and new, because Republicans have been more of the national security party, the willingness to go to war. And the fact that he is able to run on that, and that became almost a winning issue for him, I think shows how fatigued our country has been of war. Right? And so answering this question about the Bible and war has a different flavor now than it did even 10 years ago, right? Where now I think the pendulum has swung to maybe a real resistance to war instead of a celebration of it. So we're going to look at four views of the Christians in war. Now, just out of curiosity, how many of you guys have a Mennonite background? Mennonite background, okay. Yeah, sorry. No, just kidding. But, I mean, what's one of the distinguishing features of a Mennonite is what?
Pacifism,
right? And so, part of the pacifist tradition is really upheld by Mennonite thinkers and scholars. And so there's two different forms of pacifism. You have a mild form and then a stronger form. The mild form would be something called non-resistance. The title chosen for this view reflects the words of Matthew 5:29, "Do not resist him who is evil. However, although physical force may not be employed to resist evil, spiritual means may be enlisted to combat evil." In this view, the Christian is dedicated to the work of the gospel as his or her highest priority as a citizen of the heavenly kingdom. One may pray for peace and must support the government, but must never be involved in any action that takes the life of another human being. If the unbelieving government needs to fight a war to fulfill its obligations to defend its citizens, let it do so, but no Christian should be an active member of the combat troops. Christians holding this viewpoint ought to request non-combatant status when fulfilling a military obligation. Okay.
Like Hacksaw Ridge.
So yeah, Hacksaw Ridge. I forgot who the main character was.
Dawes.
But, huh?
Dawes.
Dawes, yeah. So highly religious. Was he a Seventh-day Adventist?
I was going to look it up.
Okay. Okay. But he wants to support his country, but he can't take a life. So he volunteers to become a medic and actually wins the Medal of Honor for his heroism at Hacksaw Ridge. By the way, that's also...
gory.
What? Yeah, it's... Yeah, I heard of another family who had their kids watch it and were traumatized for a while. So just be aware. Mel Gibson loves bloodshed in every movie that he directs. So careful with that one.
Okay. Yeah, Seventh-day Adventist.
Seventh-day Adventist, okay? Then you have Christian pacifism, where the basic philosophy undergirding the non-resistant view is also foundation of the Christian pacifist view. The key difference is that the Christian pacifist will not serve in the military in any role, whereas non-resistance adherent may serve in a non-combatant role. The Christian pacifist must be a conscientious objector. Views that tend to pacifism rest upon the Sermon on the Mount. The viewpoint also relies on the scriptural background of Matthew 5:21, Exodus 20:13, and Deuteronomy 5:17. Yeah, thou shalt not murder. The Christian pacifist believes that Christians are called upon to counteract the world's warlike tendencies by promoting spiritual love and peace, which Christ exemplified. Okay? So, many questions about these two. Do you see the difference?
Yeah.
I mean, what are the merits of these two positions that you could see? What would be attractive about them?
Values of sanctity of life.
Yeah. So you can imagine, where do you think somebody who's a pacifist would fall on, let's say, capital punishment? Yeah, they'd probably be opposed to it, right, to be consistent. What are some other points in favor? Why would this be attractive to many people?
It'd be attractive to answer the question a little bit more clearly. You talk about how just and unjust.
Mm-hmm.
Every single, there's a lot more to evaluate.
Mm-hmm.
You just cut that option all off.
Right, you avoid the moral wrestling.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to stay out of that.
Yeah, they're sin on both sides. I kind of support either regime. Other reasons why I might be attracted?
I mean, it keeps you safe. Like, that's attractive.
Mm-hmm. You don't have to sign up for the military.
You're not going to be one of the front lines, ever.
Yeah.
That's attractive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Honestly, I think it's horrible because fathers would allow their family to be raped and killed without doing anything to defend them.
Okay. So, and that's an interesting point we're going to bring up, right?
Yeah, because you wouldn't necessarily be safe. If you don't fight for your country, they come into your country and they kill your family, you're not safe.
Yeah.
So I understand what you mean by you're safe by not going, but you're also safe, not safe by not going.
Of course, you made an interesting connection, right? She kind of took war over here and applied it to like a personal situation, right? If somebody were to come in.
I was wondering that with the non-resistance, what if somebody comes into your house? Or?
Yeah, do you do that there, right? So they kind of get into a real ticklish situation when you deal with, so are you pro-police or anti-police?
Right,
because if you're able to do self-defense as an individual, can you do self-defense as a country? Right?
As an organization.
Yeah, and so that leads to the just war theory. And so they sought to establish guidelines about whether or not you can fight a just war. And we'll go through these kind of one by one and kind of evaluate the merits and the need for it.
Pardon, can I say something?
Sure.
I think the kind of the background for this, the pacifist way of thought, was that before they came to this country, their countries were making them go to war for not the reasons our country goes to war.
Yeah.
What we consider unjust.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just to take over land or possessions or to acquire wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I'm not sure that the pacifist view is correct for this country.
Okay.
Because of the way our government has.
And at that time, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't it that there was mandatory service for all males at the time when all of this was formulated? I think there was mandatory service, and there was all these wars of aggression.
Well, it's Germany, they were forced to go fight for Hitler. I mean, it's just, of course, you don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Right.
And we're going to talk, and we'll get into a few of the biblical reasons for pacifism. Because I think it's an attractive. It's a very attractive option, I think, especially for young people, to kind of gravitate towards this. So we'll evaluate that a little bit more in the future, but let's look at just kind of breaking down just war theory, okay? So the first thing you need is a just cause. Basically, a war must be defensive in posture, not aggressive, okay? So why would that be important?
Not starting the fight that you're sure in.
Yeah. Okay. The intent also must be just. The objectives must be peace and the protection of innocent lives. Right? I mean, that's kind of self-evident. You know, so keep in mind they're taking the self-defense posture.
Mm-hmm.
All right, where we're not going out to try to take something from other people. We are trying to prevent people from taking things from us. War must be a matter of last resort when all attempts at reconciliation or peaceful resolution has been exhausted. Right. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And this is where it gets a little bit interesting. A just war must be accompanied by a formal declaration by a properly constituted and authorized body. Now, why would that be important? Mike, what do you think?
How many years has it been since we've had a declared war?
Yep.
World War II.
Operation Desert Storm.
Huh?
I think we had a formal declaration.
Was it a formal declaration?
I think so. It was get out of Kuwait.
But was it congressional?
I think so.
It went through Congress. I can't remember if it was a declaration of war.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking that, okay. Well, if it was. I mean, but...
Yeah, I mean, Operation Desert Storm, when you look at it, Iran invaded Kuwait. Bush developed an international coalition. I think he did a formal declaration of war.
Okay.
Well, and then he pushed him out of Kuwait, and then he stopped, which is...
Mm-hmm. Tragic.
Which is interesting. Yeah, people say it's tragic or whatever, but I think when you look at just war theory, you might be able to make a case.
Well, that could be too.
That was a just war, and it was limited.
Well, I stand corrected. But most everything else was an executive order.
Yeah.
Or just
or like a police action.
A police action. There you go. Let's go with that. Yeah.
Yeah. So...
My Wikipedia sources say, in 42, we declared state of war. Since then, U.S. has used the term authorization to use military force.
Authorization.
Okay. As in the case of Iraq.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And after 2011, there was also the authorization to use military force. But there was no war declared. You're right, since World War II.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the function of it. I mean, like when you look at George W. Bush, you remember him on... national TV, and he gave Afghanistan 48 hours to turn over Osama bin Laden. Right? So there was a... when you look at the function of the declaration, I mean, why do you need to make a declaration or make some statement that we've authorized use of force, we plan on doing it? I mean, how would that feed into a just war?
You're giving them the chance to make it right before going to war.
Yeah, giving them a chance to do that for the government, and what else?
Everybody's on board.
Yeah.
You don't have a resistance inside your representation.
Yeah.
For the people who want to know if it's just or not, like if you're making an official declaration, you know why.
It also gives the other side a chance to kind of sift and separate as well, right? You know, are you going to join the military or not? Are you going to back away from this? It's kind of like sometimes... boy, what was that Bible story where they surround the city and they say, we're going to go ahead and tear this down and siege it unless we get, you know, the heads of these people. Mm-hmm. Next thing you know, heads are thrown over the wall. All right, we're good. But the fact that you have an authorized governing body, there's another purpose of that too, which is negotiating terms of peace with the other governing body. Do you see what I'm saying? So they're trying to make the decision as dispassioned and as impersonal as possible. The objectives must be limited, unconditional surrender or total destruction are unjust means. Military action must be proportionate both in the weaponry employed and the troops deployed. So just enough, well, I'm going to say just enough, but enough to get the job done, but the goal is not to burn down the city or nuke it. Non-combatants must be protected. And military operations must demonstrate the highest possible degree of discrimination. Okay, and so, again, easier said than done, but that should be the intent of the military.
Mm-hmm.
And without a reasonable hope for success, no military action should be launched. Like, if you just know we're going to get whipped here, you know, there's no way we can win, we'll just cause more bloodshed and just don't pursue the objective. Okay? So although just war theory may seem fairly straightforward, it is in reality a very complex matter. Consider the possible combinations and the interrelationships of the factors. One, an unjust cause and just means. Right? The Germans actually treated their POWs, especially in the West, reasonably well compared to, let's say, the Japanese, right? So some of the German command, not all of them, when they went to Russia, they were very brutal, but you know, they might have some just means and they abide by the Geneva Convention. Just cause and unjust means, right? They were on the, you know, the country's on the right side, but they're very vicious in how they go about it. Unjust cause and unjust means, and that's easy. A just cause and just means, and that's kind of what you want. But Remember, too, that all of these possible combinations apply to at least two different sides in the conflict, friend and foe. How should each criteria apply to each side in the conflict? Quote, since human beings of mind and will are involved on both sides of the conflict, it is often hard to determine what is a just cause in asserting or shunning a just hegemony. Hegemony means domination, preponderance, and influence and authority. War is never simple, it's always complex, it's not a black and white matter, not even gray. If anything, it is blood red. So, have we ever fought a perfect, just war? World War II, I mean, we...
Until the nuclear bomb.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think imprisoning some of the Japanese Americans. You know, there were a few. I mean, there were some things that we did. Not just a nuclear bomb, but I think a lot of the carpet bombing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that we did in Tokyo and Dresden. the second nuclear bomb.
That's what it gets. There's lots of questionable things.
But was it a? So, but what's the? Yeah, go ahead.
I think it's a lot more the way we're doing it now. Makes more sense to me because we were fighting like ISIS, which is a group of Islamists. We're not fighting the whole Islamic religion or Islamic country. So I like the idea you send in a SEAL team and take out the leader and you're done.
Mm-hmm.
Makes more sense to me. You know, and it just about does all the a just means and a just cause.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. And you don't do it unless you're sure you can succeed.
Yeah.
And
but I think when we took out Osama bin Laden, some of his family died too, right?
Oh yeah, I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah. But that's the case where when they use human shields.
But we didn't We didn't wipe out the whole city or something, you know.
Yeah.
We could have got in that way.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, but
we could have dropped the Moab on him and
And same way with this guy that the last two guys that Trump took out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They were leaders, and it, you know, you don't hear much about ISIS anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
then you have preventative war,
mm-hmm.
Kind of an extension of a just war theory. This view is an extension of just war position. It supports preemptive action or strike first options, even with nuclear weapons when necessary. If an enemy's aggression is thought to be imminent and unavoidable, preventive war adherents also advocate the use of military force to recover territory unjustly seized by an aggressor. Indeed, such aggressors may be struck without warning while they are residing in their conquered territory in apparent peace. Yeah. So, preventative war.
Or like Israel's Six-Day War, right? We're all glad they did preventive war there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, any questions about this? So, when we talk, I think one of the big things to think about is being the biblical allowance for war doesn't mean that any war is acceptable. Okay, so there is a certain code of ethics.
Say that again.
The biblical defense of war does not say that all war is acceptable. There is a code of ethics that must be followed. It must be fought in the right way. So theoretically, I would be a just war theorist, where if it's done theoretically right. Now, one of the issues that people might say is, you know, because if you look at every single war, you could find some violation of this. That is true, but the exceptions... only, I think, prove the rule, you know, where we do have a sense of what's right and what's wrong, and there's a goal to try to do it as perfectly as possible. I mean, same thing with commerce or any human interaction, right? There is an ideal to be sought for, okay? But let's look at pacifism. We'll interact with that in a few minutes. So the biblical arguments for pacifism. The New Testament emphasis on loving your enemies makes killing immoral. So one thing that they really focus on is, if you look at the Old Testament, the Old Testament clearly allows for war. You have to be blind to the Bible to say otherwise, right? Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho. You have David proved his valor. You know, David praising God, who, you know, trained his hands for war. But what they would say is, you know, the Bible kind of is truth upon truth, and when you get to Jesus, he kind of changes the way we see everything. And so you can basically say that the teaching of Jesus supersedes the teachings of the Old Testament. And when we look at Jesus, we see that he teaches, blessed be the peacemakers. He told the disciples to put away your sword, for all who draw the sword will die by the sword. Obviously, he talks about turning the other cheek. And all of this is confirmed throughout the New Testament. Now, pacifist interpretation of these and other texts leads to the conclusion that Christian is precluded from military combat and certain offices within the government. Augsburger writes, thus, Christians should only serve at government levels where they can honestly carry out the functions of their office without compromising their fidelity to Jesus Christ as Lord. They should not consider holding positions where they could not both fulfill the obligations of the office and remain consistent with their membership of the higher kingdom of God. So here's some questions. If we do have a right to life, what precautions should we take to preserve both ours and others? All right, if everybody has a right to life, what precautions should we? Now, keep in mind, there's a reason why I went through capital punishment before I did this. If there is a right to life, everybody has a right to live, what are some precautions that we should take to affirm and even protect that?
You have a right to life up until when?
Mm-hmm.
Until you kill somebody?
Yeah.
Until you kill 10 people?
Mm-hmm.
You know, until you lead a, until you become Hitler?
Mm-hmm.
When is your right to life relinquished?
Well, remember we talked about this with the issue of capital punishment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Catholic Church would say, well, all killing is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you harmonize, let's say, a pro-life Christian, which I would assume all of us are here, with somebody who might be in favor of capital punishment? You know, how do you harmonize the two?
To take out the person who is threatening multiple lives.
Not just threatening, but who took a life, right? If you take a life, you attack the image of God, right? That's the personal offense that God takes. And so in some ways, I mean, capital punishment, in the way it's biblically prescribed, is pro-life because it's about valuing and esteeming life by punishing those who take it. Does that make sense? And so, but you look at another being pro-life, I mean, there's other implications too, right? How else, what are some other situations where pro-life might show itself in what might be interpreted violent action?
Say the question again.
In what other situations could somebody be pro-life and take violent action, even taking a life? Self-defense, right? Someone is coming at you.
Or your family.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one is innocent and one is guilty, usually.
Mm-hmm. Person coming at you with a knife is guilty, right?
Mm-hmm.
How about this? How can restraining a murderer by deadly force be a loving action?
You could be protecting the other person.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe deter other people.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
I've got somebody breaking into my house to steal my money. I'm my loving people are my family. I don't know that guy. I don't love him yet.
Yeah, but you're preventing him to commit a crime against God.
Yeah. Yeah, which is an interesting thought, right? I mean, the verse I have cited here, Luke 12:47-48, basically teaches degrees of punishment in hell. That hell is not the same experience for everybody. Some people have it worse than others. And so by preventing somebody from committing murder, even by death, it is something that will, I mean, hell is a terrible, miserable place, but it'd be worse if he went through with that.
I think
so, the intent there and the actions to commit the crime being killed before committing it would make it less punishment?
Well, I mean, the actual commission of murder, I mean, as much as you're still guilty before God of intent, right?
Right.
But when you actually kill somebody, it is, I would say, and even Jesus would recognize that that's an even worse crime.
Mm-hmm.
there is remorse and regret for committing that, not that you took a life.
Where you think about like somebody who murders, like we put them away so that they will not murder other people,
mm-hmm.
So that their sin doesn't compound, you know, like
mm-hmm.
they stop at the one murder.
Yeah. Yeah. So another one is you have the Sermon on the Mount. A closely related argument claims that the Sermon on the Mount, particularly Matthew 5:38-48, is normative for Christian conduct today. The text does not simply express an attitude Christians should have in the face of opposition and persecution, but it literally prescribes appropriate conduct for Christians. Now, question one, if the Good Samaritan came upon the robbers while they were in the act, what measures would he take? What do you think? If the Good Samaritan came upon the robbers in the act, what action would he take?
He should stop it. He should intervene because
mm-hmm.
they're committing sin against whoever owns whatever it is and,
mm-hmm.
and probably potential harm.
Mm-hmm.
He has an obligation to step in and stop it
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
yeah.
I mean, think about this situation now. If, let's say, somebody broke into my house and took a knife from my family, is it loving for me to tell them to turn the other cheek? Now, you could say, well, could you just restrain them? If the man was a certain size, I could. But if this guy was high, 6'6", played college football, and I know physically there's no way I could restrain him.
Or small and armed.
Or small and armed. But we'll just do force for force, like he's bigger than me, and I happen to have a gun. What should I do in that situation? Yeah, shoot the leg, right? Yeah. So Lily has never tried to shoot a handgun. So. But yeah, do you see what I'm saying? Like, what is a loving action? And I think that's really the weakness of the pacifist position, is it makes some very generous assumptions about human nature. That there really are evil people who want to do evil things, and the only reason why they are restrained is the threat of deadly force. So, questions about that? So that's kind of what you brought up, right?
Yeah, I'd heard that by a guy, and I forgot the words and the verses that he used on it, but it's really good. Do the loving thing and shoot them.
Yeah, and that's why, I mean, I know there's a seminary, the guy I knew from seminary here wrote this big book on Christian pacifism, and I read an interview where he was just kind of pressed on that issue. If somebody broke into your house and was in the process of raping your wife, and you knew he was going to kill her afterwards, you wouldn't do anything?
I think, and
he actually, to his credit, said, I probably would.
I think that we don't want to forget that it can be the intent behind the action that makes it justifiable or not. So if someone comes in, threatens your family, and it's someone you hate, and you don't really care about your family, you're like, this is my chance.
Yeah.
And you kill the guy, that's not justifiable. If your motivation, your goal is just the death of that man,
yeah,
and you don't really care about life of your family,
yeah,
that's not justifiable. If your goal is to preserve the life of your family, and you don't care if the man dies, but you want to preserve the life of your family, that's justifiable. So the action can be identical,
mm-hmm.
but it can be justifiable or sinful,
yeah,
based on what is motivating you to take that action.
Yeah, is the goal to take a life or save a life?
Right, right.
And the goal is to save a life by taking a life. Yeah, Seth?
Scott brings up a good point here. There's been a case where there was a gentleman that was getting stolen from repeatedly.
Right.
And he got in his garage, hid in his garage,
with a loaded weapon,
set a trap for someone to
open the garage.
Yeah, they walked in
and
he killed them. And that is a case where, no,
yeah.
that force was not justified.
You yeah. allowed. And, that, and again, that was taking property.
Right.
Not taking a life.
Right.
Right.
Which is different.
But Texas, I don't think
his... Has this, right. Does Texas still have that law where you defend your property with deadly force?
Yeah, well, this state had that law, but I think they found him guilty.
It was in Oklahoma. Anyone.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, because I remember that case, because when I went through my... When I went through my concealed carry class, they talked about that case. And they said, if you do that, we have the Castle Doctrine in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. If you do that, though, you can be charged still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like if the guy has a water hose and he's coming at you with a water hose, you're allowed a water hose.
Yeah.
If he's coming at you with a knife, okay, then you might be able to bump up to a gun.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
So what would be the ramifications of turning the other cheek? If everybody in the government, right? If everybody had this pacifist ethic in the government, how safe would Emporia be?
Be ruled by the toughest warlord.
Yeah, exactly. I think Becky said the other day, pacifism is only feasible in a stable environment.
Because you look, yeah. So it'd be one of those things like I can't pull a gun and protect other people, but I'm glad that we're going to let the government do my dirty work.
Exactly. It's a luxury of a stable society
where
you can have some within it who are pacifists because the others are doing the dirty work for them. And that's just selfish.
Yeah.
I don't want to wrestle with the moral ambiguities, so I'm going to let somebody else who deal with that.
Yeah.
That's just selfish.
Well, next week, we'll continue our scintillating discussion.